You're not going to know before the correction occurs. That's my point. And so you're going to lose 3, 2, 3, 4% off the top of the market before you're going to have an indication that says, I need to become a lot more aggressive about hedging risk. Now, I would recommend hedging risk now.
Welcome to Thoughtful Money. I'm its founder and your host, Adam Taggart, welcoming you back at the end of another week with my good friend, the juggernaut, portfolio manager, Lance Roberts. How are you doing, Lance?
I'm good. I'm good. You know, the juggernaut's the guy that wears the suit and just runs through walls. So I guess that is me.
That is right. So that's the X-Men character. Yep. But the juggernaut has a millennia old definition, but it's basically an unstoppable force. Right, which I think it's pretty good of your character. I think it's pretty accurate, but certainly describes the market rally right now. That thing just keeps on going. So I want to talk about the latest price action in the markets. We'll get to your S&P charts real quick. Folks, before we dive into that, I just want to remind folks, we're now a week away from Thoughtful Money's spring conference. So if you have not bought your tickets yet, folks, pause this video, go do it right now. Get that out of the way. Make sure you don't miss it. It's going to be a phenomenal day. Yes, sir?
I was just going to say, and if you do it right now, he'll give you that early bird discount just for doing it right now.
Thanks. Now I got to edit that out, buddy. But you will get a set of Ginsu knives. No. But seriously, folks, it's going to be amazing. We're going to have Lacey Hunt do the keynote. We'll have Stephanie Pomboy. We'll have Ted Oakley. We'll have Michael Pinto. We'll have Danielle DiMartino Booth. We'll have Brent Johnson. We'll have Tom McClellan. We'll have Melody Wright on housing. We'll have Matt Pippenberg talking about gold. We'll have Mark Moss talking about Bitcoin. Of course, we'll have all of our financial advisors like Lance and the guys from New Harbor and Jonathan Wellen from Canada. So it is amazing brain trust you'd be able to tap into that day. It's going to be wonderful. All right. So moving on to the juggernaut at hand, Lance.
Yes.
So let's talk about the latest S&P action, which is getting boosted now by the yet another blowout jobs report. I got a lot of color commentary around that, which I'll save until we get to talk about jobs specifically. But that's one of the things that's pushing market higher, that pushed markets higher on Friday. Love to hear your thoughts on this, but let's talk for a second on the bull side, right? You know, reminding me, Adam, you're oftentimes, you know, too bearish, or a lot of the guests on this channel are bearish. So what's the bull story here? What's going to keep the juggernaut going for the rest of this year?
Well, it's not going to keep going the way it's going for the rest of this year. I just published an article today talking about presidential market cycles and what happens, you know, during that. And you know, when we get into kind of June, July, August, around there, I mean, you need to expect this market to correct by 10%-ish again. And again, that's kind of the same correction we had last year, but expect about a 10% pullback here before the election. And the reason is simply, you know, just in normal history, markets kind of hedge a little bit of risk going into the election because you don't know who's going to win for sure, right? I mean, you know, incumbents usually win when you have very strong economic growth, strong employment, doing great. The incumbent usually gets elected. But, you know, you can't always bank on that. And you don't know if the other person wins, maybe what type of policies you're going to get. Are you going to get tax hikes? You can get tax cuts. You just don't know. So there's risk going into a normal election. And this isn't anything but a normal election this year. You know, one of the outsized risks this year is, you know, if you know, one candidate gets elected or the other, do we have a bunch of social unrest? Do we have a bunch of riots? You know, whatever. So there's even some outsized risk on top of the normal risk of the markets. So, you know, it was interesting last night in the State of the Union address, you know, President Biden was talking about corporations need to pay their fair share, going after the healthcare sector because of the high cost of drugs and those type of issues. You know, none of that's market positive. So, you know, theoretically, if he gets elected and he's getting elected on this premise, he's going to hike the tax, corporate tax rates, et cetera. That's not great for stocks. So, again, you know, it's unlikely that this current sprint and the market is going to continue indefinitely, and particularly it won't happen through the end of this year. So you're going to have a correction. You need to be aware and ready for that at some point. And that's probably going to happen, you know, within the next, 3 to 4 to 5 months.
Okay. I just wanted to note this stat here. And again, I'm just trying to beat the bull drum just to see what we can get out of it here.
Sure.
With 98% of companies reported, S&P 500 Q4 GAAP earnings per share are up 22% over the prior year. This is the fourth straight quarter of positive year-over-year growth and the highest growth rate since Q4 of 2021. So, you know, there is earnings propelling the growth here in the stock price. Now, we can argue if the multiple that's being put on those earnings is fair, but the E is actually increasing here. Does that momentum make you feel like, okay, I mean, you've said, hey, you think there's going to be a 10% correction at some point here, but does that momentum lead you to think maybe not in the near future? And of course, we can pull up your chart too and look at the current to see what's going on.
Yes, we've had very strong earnings growth from quarter four of this year, quarter four of 2023 versus 2022. And that's not surprising, because in 2022, you had, the economy was slowing down, you had the Fed hiking rates, you had the market down 25%, 19% at close, but at one point we're down 25%. So, you had two very weak quarters of growth. So again, when you're coming off of that contraction in earnings, right, then you have a boost in earnings because of liquidity, the Inflation Reduction Act, the CHIPS Act, all those type of things. Yeah, you're going to have a fairly decent expansion in earnings, which you saw. Unfortunately, that didn't occur across the board. Not every company experienced 22% earnings growth. It was in a few companies, primarily in the tech sector, that really made up a big chunk of that earnings growth. For the rest of the market, that was growing at pretty much what you would expect, which is normal kind of economic growth rates, 5, 6, 7%. And that's where we're going to wind up over the next year. And this is this weekend's newsletter. But we're talking about that over the course of this year. All the earnings growth expectation is coming from seven stocks. The rest of the market actually has flat to negative earnings growth for the rest of this year. Earnings are tied to economic growth. So if the economy is slowing down, which it is, our rate of growth is declining. We're going from, over 9% economic growth, we're down to 3, and that's going to be sub, probably closer to 2% by the time we get back to normality. Earnings can't outpace economic growth long term. It will do that coming out of recessionary spats or recessionary downturns. But once you get back into the growth mode, earnings growth has to track the economy. Earnings growth will go back to growing at 3 or 4 to 5%, somewhere there, depending on the sector of the economy as well. And that's also going to exacerbate once all this money that was shifted into the industrial sector, the basic material sector through the Inflation Reduction Act, once those dollars start to come out of the economy, earnings growth for those companies will slow as well. So again, okay, that's just, it's just a function of that, we created a whole bunch of artificial demand through government spending. And so once that government spending is done, once we build the road or build the building or whatever it's done, then you're just to whatever that asset is going to produce. And so those rates of activity are going to slow.
Okay. We'll get into one more bullish note on the stock that's been driving the markets, NVIDIA. It's trading at like $920 a share time we're talking here, Lance. So do you think that is now beginning to feel the tractor beam of the big, large round number, the 1,000 milestone? So could sentiment just carry NVIDIA to that because folks want it to be there? And of course, that'll bring the market higher as that happens.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's within 300, it's within like 600 billion market cap now of being the largest company in the S&P. So it's number 3 or number 2 right now. So it's very close to being the largest company in the S&P. In fact, Mike and I were just talking about that this morning. If you take a look at the sales for Microsoft, and I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but Microsoft sales revenue runs about 80 billion and 88 billion, almost 90 billion. And NVIDIA's revenue is about 30 billion. And yet this company is right on its heels of actually being larger than Microsoft. So, you know, just, you know, and after, you know, it was also interesting right after NVIDIA reported earnings, they were trading at about 33 times sales. They're now almost 40 times sales because of this run up. So it doesn't matter how fast the company can grow revenue. The stock price is outpacing the revenue growth.
Yeah. And it's so funny because I have talked about NVIDIA's price to sales ratio being crazy. And several times I've said like, yeah, it's trading at 40 times sales. And then they release earnings and their earnings and sales grow so much that the price to sales ratio gets whacked down. But then the price goes up so much again, it goes back up to 40 times. It's crazy.
Exactly. And again, you know, look, there's a definite outcome to this. I mean, you know, you physically can't grow earnings at this pace forever, right? It's just, it's a function of math. You know, it's very interesting. I did this tweet earlier this week. Back in 2000, Cisco traded with a 50% margin, and they had 50% of the market share at that time in routers. And everybody said, oh, the internet's the thing, and Cisco's going to dominate this because, you know, the internet's going to change the world and everybody's got to have a router. And so, you know, this growth rate for Cisco's earnings is going to continue indefinitely. Well, it's been 23 years now and investors are almost back to even on Cisco. Interestingly, NVIDIA has a 75% market share with a 75% margin, and people think that this is going to continue indefinitely. Now, I'm not saying that it's about to have this major crash, but what happened to Cisco is the same thing that will happen to NVIDIA, because when you have this type of market that's driving this much activity, you're going to draw in other competition. AMD is already competing with it. I mean, you know, both those positions in our portfolio are up well over 100% now since we bought them. But AMD's tracking NVIDIA right now because they're in the same space. So if NVIDIA goes up, AMD goes up. And that's just kind of the case in point. So other players will come into this market. And as more players come into this market, they're going to eat into that market share. They're going to eat into that revenue growth. And there's really smart people in China.
And they'll definitely eat into the profit margin too.
Well, exactly. And look, there's really smart people in China and other countries that are working on these same projects and products. And somebody's going to come up with a better tool than NVIDIA. You know, I don't know what that could be, but at some point, somebody will come up with a better
or a better value than NVIDIA, Maybe not quite as good, but a lot cheaper. Yeah,
exactly. And that was my next point. Or come up with a competitive product that's cheaper, and all of a sudden you start losing market share. And this is what happens all the time. I mean, if you take a look at Cisco back then, Cisco in 2000, they were the predominant provider of internet routers. Now you can go to the Walmart and you can pick up routers from 50 different people to go put in your house, right? I mean, it's just, you know, they're just, and they're cheap. And so the issue is that back then routers were very expensive. Today, routers are a dime a dozen. Literally, you can buy routers very cheaply, you know, get one for $100 and do whatever you need to do in your house. So, you know, that's going to happen with all of this down the road. So the ability for NVIDIA to grow earnings at the rate that they're growing them will end. And that's ultimately where the price will have to start reflecting what the earnings growth is going to be. And look, we've seen this happen with companies, Palo Alto Networks, which we bought recently. They announced earnings, and all they said in their earnings announcement, again, this was a stock that was trading just like NVIDIA, going, you know, kind of just parabolic through the roof. All they said was, hey, we're going to change our strategy for growth so we can grow more aggressively in the future. And the stock was down 26%. They killed revenue. They killed estimates. You know, fundamentally, the company's doing great. But they just said this one thing in their earnings announcement. The stock was down 26% the next day. So we bought some on that dip.
Along with Nancy Pelosi, I saw, by the way.
Exactly. And so, yeah, well, we only buy what Nancy buys. So she calls us, tells us what she's buying. And then, you know,
we joke, but that would be the world's best strategy up to now.
Well, I forget the ETF symbol. There's an ETF that actually tracks her trades.
Yeah. Yeah. The guys at Unusual Whales. Yeah. They publish that.
Yeah. So anyway, but the point is that, you know, that's going to happen. NVIDIA is going to come out, and they're going to announce earnings and go, hey, we grew earnings at 100% this quarter. We just knocked the cover off the ball. but we think that next quarter we might be a little bit, you know, our growth rate won't be quite as good, right? Just, I mean, it can be something just very nebulous, right? You know, we potentially see a slowdown in activity over the course of the next quarter. When that happens, the stock will be down 50% in a day.
Yeah.
Because that's how much, you know, enthusiasm is priced in the stock. Look, this is a meme stock. It's getting chased along with all the other meme stocks. Meme stocks are back, by the way. Bitcoin is back. And so you've got all this speculative trading. I've actually got an article coming out on Tuesday about gold and Bitcoin, which has now become speculative assets. There's a very high correlation between gold, Bitcoin, and NVIDIA over the course and the S&P over the course of the last 3 years. So, you know, if you remember back in 2022, as the market sold off, gold sold off with it, Bitcoin sold off with it. As markets rally, those assets all rally. So they've all be. So we've moved into a market where we have a theoretical correlation of one across assets. So just whatever is moving, we just throw money at everything and drive those prices higher. So, you know, when you've got stocks or gold or Bitcoin that's trading at 75 and 80 on relative strength, trading at 4 standard deviations from their moving averages, this is a great time to take profits and start, you know, rethinking about rebalancing your risk.
All right. Interesting. I can't wait to read that. The gold part, there'll be some interesting post discussion on, because I've talked to some folks recently who, I mean, when the markets run, money does kind of generally go everywhere. But, you know, their argument is Bitcoin is largely, well, gold is reflecting more the liquidity and the destruction of the purchasing power, and Bitcoin to a certain extent, but Bitcoin, they're saying that's much more of a speculative fervor versus what's happening in gold.
But look, that's the whole thesis thing, right? I mean, I can make that same thesis for NVIDIA. NVIDIA is going to keep going up forever because it now reflects the new future of AI. So look, when things are going up in price, we always look for a rationalization of why things are going up in price, right? That's all these stories are. So yeah, everybody's got an opinion. All I'm saying is, from a technical basis and what's going on in the markets, things are mostly extended, and they are at levels where previously you had very big corrections in those prices. Now, that doesn't mean they're going to crash. It doesn't mean they're going back to zero. That doesn't mean any of that. It just means that you are going to get to a point where you will see those assets correct by 20, 30, 40, 50% again, and particularly in the case of Bitcoin. But in gold, you can see a 20% correction. In NVIDIA, you can see a 20% correction. In the market, you're going to see a 10 to 15% correction. That's coming. It's just a function of what triggers it.
Good. And we're getting to that, because I do have your recent post here, that if there's anything else you want to say about it, about the valuation metrics and volatility suggesting caution here and the way you're talking about, well, I'll let you expound on that. All I wanted to say is I'm looking forward for your piece to come out so I can take that correlation data to some of those folks who are talking, sort of, you know, trying to parse their rationale.
Yeah.
So we can hear their answer to it. Because we're getting to this very interesting point in the market where smart people see things differently. Right.
Yeah.
I find that we're getting to the point in the market where, you know, you as the eagle, who tries to be balanced, is falling on the side of like, yeah, this is really getting overextended. and to your point of corrections that could be, you know, anywhere between 10 to 50%, right, is, you know, when you say the market could correct by 10%, you know, it probably will, but there are players in there that are way so far extended right now that they're going to have, you know, potentially much larger drawdowns.
Yeah. And real quick, before you jump off, you know, there's also players in there that have already corrected. And as a good example, Apple and Google have had very, very big corrections here lately. They're very oversold. In fact, we'll probably be adding to our positions that we own in those companies. But what my point about this is that we could see a correction in the market of 10%, and we could see NVIDIA go down by 20, 25%, and we could see Apple and Google actually go up in price. So there's, you know, and so there's also assets within the market that have already corrected. There are assets that are trading at fair value. And so when you start looking at your portfolio, and this is what we do, is start looking for some of these out of favor assets that money will likely rotate to. Because look, money's not going to leave the market, right? Money will rotate within the market. So we're looking for assets to where those assets may, where those monies may rotate to during a correction.
Well, and you know what's so interesting about that? So of course, that's that's the objective of the active manager, right? Is to find out where better value is and get there. But as the Magnificent Seven has been, you know, driving the markets up over the past years, you've said, you know, hey, Apple is one of those classic stocks where you can kind of park yourself in because you're never going to get fired for owning Apple. It's so big, it doesn't really get wanged around that much. And it was one of the beneficiaries, it has been one of the beneficiaries of the positive net capital flows that have been going, the passive capital flows that have been going into the market.
Yep.
So with Apple at a lower price, presumably it becomes a much more attractive place to park money where you're like, I don't want to be out of the market right now. But it's that big safe behemoth that has already sort of pre-corrected, to your point.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Look, it pays a dividend, and you know it's highly liquid. So as a portfolio manager, if I'm like a major hedge fund and I've got $100 million that I need to park somewhere, right, I can park it in Apple because I can move $100 million in and out of Apple in a day, and it doesn't move the price. But if I try to park it in something like SCMI, you know, the small cap company that's making this magical leap to large cap next week, you know, I'm going to move that price of the stock all over the place. So, you know, as a portfolio manager or a hedge fund manager, it, you know, Apple, Microsoft, Google, those are those safe haven plays that I can put money into. Meta is the same way.
Okay. Presumably I'm thinking Tesla might not be as attractive to you as a safe haven park right now.
Actually, we were just looking at look, I'm not a big Tesla fan. So don't get me wrong. I think Elon Musk is great. I'm not a huge fan of EVs, or, you know, electric vehicles in total, because we're kind of looking at the trend of EV sales. Those are starting to slow down a bit. If you take a look at what's happening with companies like Albemarle that produce lithium, that stock has been decimated. And by the way, there's another company that is starting to become very compelling. If you take a look at what's happening in that space, there's certainly some concerns about the strength of EV sales going forward versus hybrids and internal combustion vehicles, particularly because of cost.
This is a deeper discussion for a deeper day, but that the pendulum is swinging back to hybrid now, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And then there's good reasons for that. But that doesn't mean that the demand for lithium or batteries are going away, because, you know, if you have a plug-in hybrid, it's still got a battery. So, you know, there's still going to be this demand for batteries, and there's still going to be a demand for electric vehicles, but Tesla does a lot of other stuff as well. So, you know, there's, it's still expensive, but it's given up a lot of that overvaluation, and it's not there yet, but you know, this is a company that's starting to trade at much closer to reasonable valuations for a company that deals a lot in technology. So again, I'm not recommending buying Tesla, and I'm not recommending buying Albemarle. So don't go out and buy this stuff because it's not ready yet. But I'm just saying, you know, there are areas that, again, are becoming a lot more compelling. And as far as a place to park money, you know, Tesla has corrected a lot of that overvaluation. It is big, it is liquid. And so as a hedge fund manager, I might be interested in using Tesla as a parking spot, no pun intended, or using Tesla as a vehicle to basically park money, in the environment. Now, again, that would be one of my last choices. I mean, Apple, right.
You pick an Apple or a Google before.
Yeah, it would be first Meta, particularly now that those are all paying dividends. But not Google, but Meta is now paying a dividend as well. So those would be my first choices, but I wouldn't necessarily count Tesla out. I think there could be an interesting rally coming up for Tesla.
Okay. One last thing on sort of the bullish side of the ledger. This is very specific to one stock, but I believe it's one that you own. Eli Lilly. Uh-huh. There's now headlines coming out that demand for, you know, its weight loss product may be exceeding supply, or it's getting in danger of exceeding supply. So that thing could continue having upward pressure on it. You're nodding, and you've ridden that stock, right?
Yeah. No, we own Eli Lilly. We're actually hoping for a correction because we want to add more to the position. But it's, you know, there the whole GLP-1 issues, which is this magical weight loss drug. It's been around forever. They used it for diabetes for a long time, and then they figured out that it also, you know, helps with losing weight. So it's becoming a much more mainstream type topic, and you're starting to see a lot more people talking about it. You're starting to see a lot more people take it. And it's interesting now because people are going, oh, well, this is going to really impact, you know, grocery stores because they're not going to sell as many groceries, right, and those type of things. And, you know, it's an interesting stretch to say that, because I know people that are on the drug and have used it. And the thing is that you don't use this forever, right? You use this for a period of time, you lose weight. And hopefully as you're losing weight, you're supposed to be changing your dietary
and behaviors. Yeah,
your behaviors. Unfortunately, that's not how it works in most cases. Because again, this isn't a drug that helps you, you know, do these other things. I mean, if you don't work out, if you don't exercise, you don't take walks every day, those type of things, that's not part of your lifestyle.
If you still eat the same crap food, just less of it, you know, crap nutrition. Yeah,
exactly. But I mean, this drug's not going to make you become an exerciser. You know, it makes you feel terrible, and that's why you don't eat. And then, you know, once you kind of get over being sick, you'll eat a little bit. But I mean, that's how this drug works. And it just makes you not want to eat. And that's not necessarily that's not a great way to be healthy. And you know, yes, it's helping you lose weight, but it's not a healthy way to lose weight.
Well, one of the questions I have about it, and this is just pure speculation, so I've got, you know, nothing to say about this, but, presumably the drug's went through all the testing it needed to beforehand, but you're running this national experiment right now where we haven't had people take the drug like this for this purpose for a long period of time. So I'm just wondering if in a couple of years we may be talking about the immense amount of lawsuits that are dragging Eli Lilly stock down because they found out that this thing does something horrible to you when you take it for too long.
What do you mean, like, you know, running a national experience, national experiment on a vaccine, and now
let's not go there to remove.
No, it's actually very interesting because, you know, they were protected from lawsuits, and now they're trying to pass a bill to open those companies up to lawsuits. So, you know, that's going to be a huge issue for companies like Pfizer, Moderna, et cetera. If they become liable for lawsuits, could be a massive impact to earnings.
Yeah. Oh, well, absolutely. Do you have any sense of where that effort is? Is it still just
it's still in discussion stage at this moment. I mean, they're trying to build support for it, but there's enough evidence out there of people that have gotten damaged from the vaccine that it's putting a lot more pressure.
Yeah. I mean, what would you expect? I mean, forget the specific vaccines, just any brand new pharmaceutical that was rushed to market like that. And you deploy to millions of people. And I mean, I think I can't remommer which brand it is, but the CDC is recommending the 8th or the 10th, you know, shot. So like, if you have this many repeated exposures to something that was rushed through trial, shouldn't be surprised that there're going to be issues with it, no matter what it is.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, I think that's something that if you're long companies like Pfizer, I'm not saying, again, I'm not recommending that you sell anything today, but I think that's something you need to really keep a watch on, because that could amount to billions of dollars of lawsuits if that liability protection gets overturned. That's the risk, right? The risk is the overturning of liability protection. If that occurs, you know, you probably don't want to be along those stocks.
Okay. All right. Well, I want to move on from the vaccine topic, folks. Definitely try not to take any particular public position.
I don't care whether you took it or not. That's all on you.
Oh, no. I'm just saying it's such a sensitive topic. I don't want the comment section to become, you know, about the vaccines. Yeah. And I understand and appreciate people's strong feelings on it. But to your point about risks to watch out for, again, back to your recent piece, valuation metrics and volatility suggest investor caution. This is sort of the basis of what you were saying about, we're at a point where a 10% correction kind of makes sense. Don't know exactly when it's going to happen, but expect it before the election. Anything else you want to say about the current state of the market?
Well, I mean, you know, look, valuations are expensive. No matter how you want to slice them, if you take a look across metrics, whether it's trailing PE, forward PE, I mean, you're just paying a lot to own equities. And this always goes back to, you know, the big disconnect between investors and, you know, what they think and what they do, right? You know, in theory, if you're overpaying for an asset of anything, your future return is not going to be high. If you pay $100,000 for a Toyota Corolla, you're not going to resell it for $100,000, right? You're probably going to lose money on that deal because you overpaid for it. Same thing with overpaying for a house. If you overpay for a house, odds are you're going to sell it for less money in the future. That's just the way, that's the way valuations work. And, you know, it's always very fascinating to me that as individuals, you know, on any other asset, no matter what it is, you go online to Amazon and you want to buy a new gadget for your kitchen, and you'll shop through 50 different suppliers that gadget, see who's going to give you the best price. And then, you know, you'll shop on Google, you know, look for the best price on a deal, or you'll go to eBay and try to negotiate a deal, you know, it's or Facebook Marketplace, you know, whatever it is, we're all looking to get a deal on something. You won't overpay for a car. You go to a dealership and you try to negotiate down the price of the car. But when it comes to stocks, you'll just pay whatever because it's going up in price. And there's a very long historical correlation between what you pay for assets and what your future returns are. But, you know, and here's the important part about this, though. Valuations are an absolutely terrible market timing device. So you should never use any type of analysis for managing your portfolio short term that has anything to do with valuations. So you should never look at valuations as any part of your metric for short-term management. Then when I say short-term, 12 to 18 months, valuations mean nothing. It's all about psychology. In fact, like this chart shows, if you look at consumer confidence, this is our consumer confidence composite. So it looks at both the University of Michigan as well as the Conference Board's measures of confidence and overlay that on valuations. Surprise. There's a correlation.
It's correlated. Yep.
Yeah. And the reason is that as people feel more optimistic, they go buy stocks. Stocks are going up in price, so they feel better. So they become more optimistic, so they go buy more in stocks. When those, you know, stock prices stop going up, well, confidence, you know, tends to go with it because they have less money and they lose money in the future. But the bottom line is that over the next 10 years, your returns are going to be probably close to zero. And really, if you look back over the last 2 years, yes, markets are doing great since November, but, you know, markets are up about 8-10% from where they were 2 years ago. So, you know, it took 2 years to get to even. Now you've made 8% on your money. So, you know, that's, you know, and now if we turn around and give that all up this year, we back to even. And then, you know, next year, the market goes down. We have a recession eventually, whatever, market goes lower. Then you rally back, get all back to even. Then you look back over 10 years and go, wow, I didn't make any money.
Right, I went nowhere. Yeah.
Yeah.
I just want to note, too, that that chart, very similar to ones that we've shared on this program of late from John Hussman, very similar scattered chart like that. So, yep. You know, when smart analysts do their own work but come to the same conclusion, that's when you really want to pay attention.
Right. And so this is another measure, though. This is, so, you know, this, and this article was kind of based a little bit on Warren Buffett, who just issued out his annual letter. And he made some very interesting comments that, you know, he can't deploy his $160 billion in cash because there's nothing to buy that A is large enough to move the needle, but B is reasonably priced.
Right.
And so if you think this is the inflation, so I do Buffett's indicator a little bit differently. I've inflation adjusted. So my numbers are a little bit different than the actual kind of mainstream media version.
But because you think you're smarter than Warren Buffett, right? That's why.
Well, yeah, exactly. But, you know, we'll tell him that. But anyway, but no, I mean, I just inflation adjust valuations and market cap for what's going on. So this is inflation adjusted market cap to GDP ratio versus the real S&P 500 index. So inflation adjusted S&P. So if you take a look at that, you know, we're trading at 2 times the value of the economy. So what does market cap to GDP mean, right? Why is that important? Well, again, stocks, companies generate their revenue from the economy. So just from that very metric, stocks should not be more highly valued than the economy because that's what generates their earnings, right? It's what you and I do in the economy. It's our activity that generates right. Their sales. So in theory, whenever the market trades above the value of the economy, in other words, a ratio of greater than one, that's typically been at market peaks. And again, back to 73, 74, we traded at 1.4 times market cap to GDP. That led to the crash of 74, dot-com crash at 212, financial crisis at 155. We were 261 during the run-up into the pandemic. And so now we're at two after the correction in 2022. And again, we're starting to work our way, you know, kind of up. So as the economy slows down, if markets keep going up, that ratio is going to start to go up very dramatically again, kind of like we saw back in 2020. But just like everything else, if we take that and spin it out and look at market cap to GDP in terms of future forward returns and the real S&P 500, that dot in the upper right-hand corner where it says 2022 correction, that was the peak of the market in early 2022. So that's how far you were outside of the norm of market cap to the S&P. We're currently very elevated, again, at two times. And if we take a look at it on a forward return basis, you know, we're looking at forward returns of somewhere around a negative 3% based on this indicator, using real market cap to GDP. So again, it's just no matter how you kind of measure valuations, you're just overpaying for assets to such a degree that ultimately your future returns are going to be disappointing. And here's one other thing about this. And I've written articles about this previously. We've spent $43 trillion in the economy since 2009, and that has boosted the average annual return of the market to 12%. Now, that boost of 4%, or that boost of 12% average annualized rates of return is 4 percentage points higher than the 8% that we generated from 1900 to 2008. Mm-hmm. So all this money that we dumped in, TAMP, HARP, HAMP, all these different things that we did, you name it, and then QE programs, et cetera, created a 50% higher rate of return than the long-term average. So that, if we just return back to normal and go back to eight, that's going to feel really disappointing compared to what people were getting, right? But, you know, now we're talking about potentially, you know, rates of return are somewhere between 3% to a negative 3%. Over the course of a decade to 20 years, and that's going to be very disappointing for investors that are used to seeing the speculative market that we've seen over the last decade.
So let me ask you this then. So you said don't use valuation to make decisions that are a quarter or two out, right? They take more than 18 months to really play out. But you're, by your own calculations, you're currently looking at, you know, numbers that, from what you just described there, are like, wow, it might be kind of rough the next couple of years as a capital allocator.
Well, again, over 10 to 20 years, right?
Yeah, and again, it's going to be the rest of your career.
Well, yeah. Well, thanks. I'm not going to be soon, I was hoping. But here's the problem with this, right? That's what valuations tell us. It doesn't tell us what the market will do during that period. And this is the important point. This doesn't mean, and this is very important. What I just said does not mean that the market is going to generate 2 to 3% every single year. You're going to have years where the market's up 10 or 20% and we want to participate in that. Then you're going to have years where the markets are down 10 or 20%. Or more, could be a 30%, could be a 40% correction. Then you're gonna have the next 3 or 4 or 5 years where the market's gonna go up 10 or 15% a year, and it's gonna be awesome. But when you go back and average all that year, if you bought the S&P today, in theory, in 10 years from now, it'll be the same price, right? But in between, it had huge rallies.
It won't be a flat table. Yeah, totally get it.
Right. Yeah. It's going to be all over the place. And that's why using valuations, though, is terrible for managing your money. But what it does tell us is that the markets are taking on, and investors are taking on, way too much risk. And they're not going to realize when the markets are turning that it's time to get out. And so they're going to wind up doing what they always do. They're going to buy high. Markets are going to correct. You'll have a 15, 20% correction. They're going to sell low. And then markets are going to run up again. They'll buy high and they'll sell low. And when they look back over time, they'll have lost money. I wrote an article just the other, just Monday, I think, or Tuesday of this week, talking about retail investors. They're still negative. They lost so much more money during 2022. The market was down 19% total return, including dividends, on an inflation adjusted basis in 2022. Average retail investor was down 35%. Markets back to all-time highs and retail investors aren't. But that's because investors do all the wrong things with managing their portfolio.
Right. And I was going to ask you something else, but now you triggered me here. So like that's honestly, like one of the very main reasons why thoughtful money exists, right, is because the retail investor is not as sophisticated as the professionals. And I'm painting with a very broad brush here, and present company excluded for all the viewers watching this channel. But you know, they're much more sort of emotion driven, herd driven, you know, oh, the people around me are getting rich on NVIDIA, I better get in, right? And what that does is it generally compels them to make the worst decision at the worst time, or at least bad decisions at bad times. And they tend to take injuries that on a percentage basis that tend to be much worse than the professionals take. And many of these people can afford to take those losses a lot less than, you know, the average professional. So it's super important to me to try to help regular people understand the nature of the game, where things are, so that they're not falling victim to their, you know, less sophisticated and more emotionally driven ways. And then they can benefit from guys like you, Lance, who are, you know, just sharing with us what a thoughtful capital manager looks at.
Yeah. And again, you know, this is, you know, but this is all that psychological, you know, issue that we fall prey to. And, you know, it's just when markets are going up, it's the fear of missing out. We've got to get in. And you know, then this was really interesting. You know, it was so fascinating to me during 2022 because the markets were going up in 2020, 2021. Remember, we were doing IPOs and SPACs, and Wall Street couldn't issue enough product for people to jump into. And of course, all the Reddit traders were, you know, buying Bitcoin and you know, every speculative asset they could get their hands on, you know, AMC and GameStop. You know, we had all those conversations. And it was so interesting to me because in 2022, as the market's correcting, everybody was like, oh my gosh, this is, you know, we're about to have this major bear market. It's all going to crash. But yet we never developed any fear in the markets. As the markets were coming down, I was getting swamped with emails like, is this the bottom? Is it time to buy? There was this, not only did we have FOMO of missing out on the way up, we had the FOMO of missing the bottom on the way down. And so everybody kept buying. This is why the market kept rallying. We'd have these sell-offs. The market would rally a whole bunch. Then the market would sell off and rally a whole bunch because everybody was trying to find the bottom, you know, to buy. And so finally the market bottomed in 2022. And, you know, we've had this huge rally ever since. And I've got a really interesting report coming out looking at the bank reserves versus the market. And there's a very neat correlation. It's a 66% correlation between bank reserves and financial markets. And bank reserves bottomed in October of 2022 and have been rising ever since, along with the market. So, you know, it's just very interesting because we see all this money getting pulled back into assets and you see this massive surge in psychology. And, you know, this is, so I have this, you know, this, you know, kind of measure and I can't take credit for this measure myself, but Sentiment Trader tracks what we call dumb money, smart money. And so I've recreated that index of dumb money investors, and it, you know, at peaks of markets, that's where dumb money is just piling in. That's the retail investor, and the reason they're called dumb money is because Wall Street is liquidating assets. They're selling their assets to the retail investor. What's been going on this year? Institutions have been selling hand over fist this year as retail investors are buying everything they get their hands on. So, you know, it's just very interesting. We're right back into the same type of story. And when you take a look at the dumb money, less smart money allocations, that's the blue, you know, that generally occurs right at peaks. Wow. And right now you've got, you know, retail investors, your average retail investor. This is the American Association of Retail Investors. Their asset allocations are basically at where market peaks have been. They have very low allocations to cash. Remember all that money on the sideline theory? There's no money on the sideline. It's all invested. Yep. And it's all in the markets. And, you know, and this is just kind of that whole thing that we've got into. You know, we're chasing, you know, everything from the lows. The S&P is outperforming everything. It's outperforming mid-cap, small-cap, you name it. There's nothing beating the S&P except the NASDAQ right now. And if you take a look at measures of, you know, kind of exuberance and speculative risk-taking, whether it's options or retail flows, they're all just pegging the roof. You know, interest in call options are spiking sharply. You got the largest weekly inflows into small cap stocks, which are your most speculative side of that kind of investment cycle in stocks. And, you know, the flows into small cap growth are outpacing everything else at this point. So again, investors are just absolutely taking on the most risk possible. And they're taking it in companies where 40% of the Russell 2000 have negative earnings growth. So, you know, it's just a disregard for any type of valuations or anything else, but it's just how fast can I get money invested into the market so I can get rich quick.
All right. So those are great charts, by the way. And folks, if you're listening on a podcast, you really should take the time to come watch this on YouTube and see those charts. So Lance, those clearly look like, you know, late stage rally or late stage peak signals, right? It sounds like the Patsy has shown up at the poker table. Wall Street is you know, institutions are dumping as much as they can on the arrival of the retail investor. So it seems to me that you're saying, you're getting down to maybe like, you know, DEFCON 2 on like, this is going to have to correct, folks, right? What are you watching on the micro side to give you a sense that will give you a sense of like, okay, correction's now imminent, right? Because right now I hear you saying it's going to correct, but it could be any time between now and the election. What are some signs where you're going to be like, okay, wait a minute, this looks like things could be rolling over real soon. I want to really start getting the safety.
Yeah. You're not going to know that. You know, that's the whole problem is that, you know, we've been talking about it correct. And we're saying, hey, we've been saying for the last month that, you know, we are set for a correction of 10%, 5 to 10% this year. But for a month, the market just keeps going up. And so, you know, naturally everybody's like, you know, he doesn't know what he's talking about. This market is just going to go up forever. And I love Twitter because Twitter's awesome. Like, cause it's just, you know, it's such a great sentiment gauge. I can put out something that suggests the market's overbought. It's like, you know, just BTFD and just, you know, buy stocks. It's all going up from here. It's never going down again. And that's a great contrarian indicator. But no, you're not going to know in advance of when.
Let me give you one example, because look, I know there's no guarantees, right? But I'm just wondering, let's say Nvidia or another continued super high flyer disappoints on its profit growth or its revenue growth, right? Would that be an indication of like, okay, wait a minute, like the price for perfection driver of the market all of a sudden just stumbled, you know?
Right. But basically, you know, this goes back to why we spend so much time, you know, looking and analyzing technicals importantly in the market. And what I'm trying to say to you is that you're not going to know before the correction occurs. That's my point. And so you're going to lose 2, 3, 4% off the top of the market before you're going to have an indication that says I need to become a lot more aggressive about hedging risk. Now, I would recommend hedging risk now. And by saying that is if you've got, you know, positions that have done really well and you've got, you know, big profits in them, take some profits. That doesn't mean sell everything. That means if the position is normally 3% of your portfolio and it's now 4, you trim it back to 3. So you just do some housekeeping in your portfolio, raise a little bit of cash, rebalance risk, rebalance your portfolio. But when this market has been running along the 20-day moving average, all the computer algorithms in Wall Street right now are watching that 20-day moving average, because every time we get down to the 20-day moving average, the buying programs kick in and the market goes up. Earlier this week, Monday, Tuesday, market sold off, hit the 20-day moving average. We've been up every day since. And this has been going on for the last 5 months now. So, you know, that 20-day moving average is very critical, because if the market breaks that 20-day moving average, closes below it, and then fails to get back above it in the next 2 days, the algorithms are going to switch from buying to selling, and they'll start selling the market there. And then you'll immediately hit the 50-day moving average, which is currently right around 49.06. If you fail there, your likely test is going to be the 200-day moving average at 45.50. So, you know, you're talking, that's about your 10% correction.
Okay. All right.
And I did this analysis on our program yesterday, but if we go back in history, just real quick to this time last year, we were having exactly the same thing going on. We had the market running along the 20-day moving average. It was all about AI. We just had the Silicon Valley Bank crisis back early in March. And then that quickly bypassed with the bank term funding program. And it was all about AI. So we had this AI chase going into April, May, June, July, the market was up 17% for the year going into July. Starting in June, we were talking about a correction. Hey, we're going to get this 10% correction, 5 to 10%. You and I discussed it repeatedly. It just didn't happen. Markets were overbought. They stayed overbought. And then finally, summer came along and we had that 10% correction. That's what's going to happen. But you'll notice that that correction didn't ensue until we took out that kind of running support line. And that's where we are right now. We've got this nice running, very trending support, nothing to worry about in this market right now until we take that out.
Okay, thanks. And this is exactly what I was asking for. So
I know you just wouldn't shut up long enough to let me explain.
But just to point out for folks here, if the S&P drops below the 20-day moving average and it doesn't bounce, it punctures below, that will be a sign for you to say, hey, I got to really start like getting serious about looking for ways to de-risk.
Right.
And I know you're saying start de-risking now, but I mean, that would probably accelerate your efforts, I imagine.
Oh yeah, no. And once we start getting a real sign that we're beginning a bigger correction, we'll start reducing our overall equity exposure, adding a short to the portfolio, doing whatever. We're also at these two shaded areas in the portfolio. So this is what's called a cup and handle formation. And so we had this big decline in 2022. We rallied. We had this correction going into October of last year. And that was the kind of the formation of the handle. So if you kind of look, it looks like a cup and a handle. And that's a very bullish formation. And so when you break out of that formation, you typically get a move that's measured from the breakout of that cup and handle formation, which would put this move that we're in right now targeted around 5,200. So we're at 5,150. So we're real close to what the targeted move of a cup and handle breakout would do. And that's actually still bullish, right? So we get a correction back towards these previous highs around 4,800, or even this high that we had back in July of last year, find support there. That would also be the 200-day moving average, very bullish, market supports there, bounces off that, then you get a continuation of the bull trend. But you need to have, at some point, a retest of that breakout support level. And a retest of the 200-day moving average would be the best. And then if we can hold that, then that would correct a lot of this overbought condition and give you a lot better opportunity to put money to work.
Got it. Looking down at the RSI there, where we see that wedge building there,
yep.
Wedges like that tend to get to a breakout point, right? Either up or down. I'm guessing you're thinking it's probably more likely down given all the things that we just talked about. But no guarantee, right? But I guess my guess is, would you expect that wedge to have a breakout point in either direction?
Well, if it breaks out to the upside, there's not a lot of upside to go, right? So that might mean that maybe the market gets to 5,300, maybe 5,400, which is kind of our target for the year. So logically, it's going to break to the down. It could break to the upside first and then break down, but the whole point of this is that you have a market that's strongly rising, but you have a negative divergence in both momentum as well as relative strength. So the MACDs, you have a negative divergence in the MACDs. They're just slowly trending lower. You're losing momentum in the markets. You've got this kind of negative divergence that's building. The slope, the downward slope in RSI, the relative strength of the market is declining. So you have this what's called negative divergences, which are contraindicators to a bull trend in the market. It suggests that the market is going to break lower at some point. We just haven't got there. And again, we go back, we talk about we have ultra low volatility right now. There's basically, the volatility index trading extremely low levels, lots of speculation in terms of call options. So you have all the ingredients for a very sharp reversal in the markets at some point. It's just a function of what triggers it.
Okay. Well, so speaking of potential triggers, your partner, Michael Leibowitz, recently put out a report titled Liquidity Problems Are Closer Than You Think.
Yep.
And let me just read a part of it, and then I'll let you run on it. He said, in the piece, he talks about liquidity that is leaving the market right now, or at least becoming more scarce. So he says, so what type of problems occur when the excess liquidity is gone? We've had all this excess liquidity that's been put in, and it is beginning to contract. For starters, banks will still have to use their reserves, to help the Treasury issue debt and absorb the Fed's balance sheet decline. Such actions will force liquidity to migrate from other parts of the financial system to the Fed and the Treasury. Without the reverse repo program to draw funds from, banks will have to tighten lending standards for consumer and corporate loans. Further, they may likely pull back on margin debt offered to speculative investors. And then finally, the cost of higher interest rates and QT will likely be felt at that point, because right now they've sort of been drowned out by the excess liquidity that's been out there. So how big of an issue do you think this could be in the rest of the year?
Fairly significant. This is what I was just talking about earlier. I'm just starting to work on this article, but I'll just share a couple of charts with you real quick. So this is overnight repurchase agreements, and that blue line you can see is declining rather sharply, and that's going to head back towards zero at some point. And that's the big concern right now. What happens here is that when you have a big expansion in reverse repo, like we had in 2020 as an example, you have a big surge in bank reserves. That's been tailoring off, and you can see that since kind of this kind of bottom that we put in October of 22 last year, bank reserves have been on the rise. So, what's important about this is that if we go back, and this is what I was saying, is that there's a very high correlation between, oops, what happened here? That's not what I want. Yeah, here's what I want. There's a very high correlation between bank reserves and so this is the cumulative weekly change of bank reserves versus the S&P. It's got about a 66% correlation. So, if bank reserves start reducing because of what's happening with the tightening of liquidity, that's going to, and again, like Mike said, banks loan money into the financial market. So they work with hedge funds, they work with their own prop desk, they provide the margin, they provide all that stuff. So if liquidity begins to get extracted because of a reduction in bank reserves, in theory, if the correlation holds, we should see a correction in the financial markets, which would be just like we saw in, back here at the peak of the market in 2021, bank reserves started contracting in 2022, and we had a correction in the financial markets. So, that's kind of the risk that we're running in terms of a contraction in liquidity.
All right. And if I can just sort of add on to this, so I just interviewed Michael Howell this week. He's Mr. Liquidity, right? That basically liquidity is everything. Yeah. And he continued his predictions that net liquidity will continue rising through the remainder of 2025, right? So mm-hmm. He's still pretty bullish on the markets, but he did say two things that were somewhat cautionary. He said, one, we're at the point where we've seen probably 60% or more of the gains that we would expect from this bull market. So he's mm-hmm. like, making more gains from here it's going to be harder, right? And secondly, he said, and it's not going to be a straight line up. And he said, Q2, he's looking at Q2 and saying, with the draining of the reverse repo program and the expiration of the BFTP and a few other things that are going on, he's just saying, look, that could be kind of a pretty volatile period. So he didn't make any hard predictions, but basically gave the impression that like, hey, I wouldn't be surprised at all if there was a material correction. Yeah. He didn't say 10%, but you're 10%, right? And so even real bullish guys like him are looking at the liquidity situation in the next quarter or so and saying, it could get a little dicey.
Yeah. And look, I mean, the correlation with the bank reserves in the market, when the repo program gets drained, then, that'll take a couple more months, right? And that's what I'm saying, you don't go panic now and sell stuff because things are fine. And again, look, let's just keep bells in line. We're talking about a 5 to 10% correction. We have 5 to 10% corrections every year. Right, so right. There's nothing outside the realm of normality of having a correction. I really want one. I would love a correction back to the 200-day moving average, because that would reverse a lot of overbought condition, get valuations down a little bit, smidge, but provide us a lot better opportunity to put capital to work at better prices. I mean, we own a lot of great companies that I would love to add to if I could just get, they're just have been running parabolic and just, I can't justify buying them at 2 and 3 standard deviations above their means. So, I need things to correct so I can put some more capital to work.
Great. Would you mind just sharing one company that if it came down into your acceptable valuation range, you'd love to buy right now?
Costco, Walmart.
Okay.
I'd buy both of them. I buy, you know, every time Costco dips, and it doesn't dip often, but you know, that's a company that just prints money. The memberships at Costco are phenomenal. People pay, I mean, it just, you know, you pay 119, 120 bucks, whatever and the memberships keep going up every year. But that's just free money. You pay this money for a membership to go shop at a grocery store and buy stuff at a profit margin that they also make. And yeah, you can buy a hot dog and a Coke for $1.50, and it's a really good hot dog and a Coke. But, you know, that's just cash flow that just, it has no cost to it to have that membership. And so they just literally print money. And so, yeah, if you can ever buy a Costco, AbbVie, Walmart on discounts, you buy those in your portfolio and don't touch them.
All right, great. I appreciate you sharing that. All right, so we spent a lot of time talking about stocks. Let's move over to bonds for a moment. Sure. So bonds prices have been rising. 10-year yield, I think, is down to what, about 4.1 right now, mm-hmm. or so. What's RIA's current view on bonds and where things are heading there?
Nothing's changed. You know, things don't operate overnight. You know, yields are a function of economic growth and inflation. Inflation will continue to work its way back down towards 2%. Economic growth will work its way down towards 2%. Yields will follow suit. So, as we've just said repeatedly, it's, you know, this is a long-term game. This is, you know, 18, 24, 36 months. You know, and inflation is being a little bit sticky right now. So we've got to get through this period. So that's going to keep inflation a little bit, keep yields a little elevated at the moment. But once we get through this period and start the next kind of leg down lower in inflation, it'll follow suit.
Okay.
And by the way, if the Fed starts cutting rates like they hinted at yesterday, that's also another big downward pressure on yields.
Right. Yep. Yep. It's going to be super interesting to see what the Fed does here. And I'm sure we'll talk about that in a little bit. If we get the 10% correction in the equity markets that you're expecting, what would you expect bonds to do during that period? Would they catch a safety trade bid, or would they be?
The yield should do well, because if we're getting a correction, you'll have a risk off momentum trade.
Okay. All right. But again, most importantly, you've said, hey, in terms of RIA and the strategies that we've shared previously on this program, in terms of your bonds outlook, you're not changing anything.
Yeah, no, and this is always interesting to me, because, you know, I get, every time yields tick up, you know, a tenth or whatever in one direction or the other, like, you know, are you doing anything? What are you doing different with bonds? Because yields ticked up on this, you know, this employment report or whatever. It's like, nothing. And, you know, this isn't a function of what happens from one day to the next. We're not trading bonds. We have a long-term thesis in bonds and portfolios, and we're collecting a coupon where we're sitting here waiting for the price appreciation to work. So there's nothing to do. You just have to be patient and let economic fundamentals work for you.
All right. Great. Yeah. We did not get into bonds much last week, and I got a bunch of questions saying, hey,
what's going on? So it's like nothing's happened. It's like, look, bonds are like watching paint dry, right? Or grass grow. Actually, a better one is grass, because it doesn't take that long for paint to dry. You know, this is like planting seeds of grass. You got to wait a while for it to grow. So just be patient, people.
Okay. All right. Well, we talked briefly about jobs earlier. I want to get your reaction to the recent jobs report. I've got a bunch of different charts here I'll try to pull up while we're talking. But, you know, another blowout jobs report, and it's business as usual, right? We tout how amazing, you know, the latest payrolls were. So this was a print of 275,000 versus expectations of 200,000. But then, of course, at the same time, they're announcing this amazing beat. They're saying, oh, well, remember last year, last month's crazy beat? Well, we're actually dramatically revising that downward. So folks might remember that last month really caught folks by surprise. It was a whopping 353,000 jobs. That's been revised down by 35% to just 229,000 jobs, which is still, you know, a decent strong jobs market. Yeah. But a 35% correction is it takes a complete outlier and puts it into the average, right? So, you know, we're continuing to see the alligator jaws between the household report, the household survey, and the establishment survey continue to widen. I'll maybe pull that chart up while I let you react here, Lance. But it just seems like, you know, it's sort of more of the same. Like, It seems more like a window dressing exercise than it does actually like a report on an economic data set.
Well, it is. Okay. So first of all, don't forget this is an election year. And yeah, every month we're revising down the previous month. And so that's, you know, that's, you know, the way this game works, but the markets don't pay attention to revisions, you know, so, and we'll come back in a year and we'll probably knock the payrolls down, you know, by another 30 or 40% by the time we get there, because it'll eventually align with the household survey. So the question is either the household survey is going to catch up or the BLS is going to catch down, one of the two. But there's a lot of anomalies that are going on in this data. The leading economic indicators is a good one too. And also consumer confidence. I love consumer confidence. They've been revising that one every month for the last several months. So, you know, if they come out and they say, how do you feel about the economy? Ah, I feel great. But you said that last month. Yeah, I didn't feel that good last month. So
I changed my mind on how I felt last month. Yeah,
you know, and so there's so much, you know, and those things shouldn't change. I mean, your opinion last month and your opinion this month shouldn't change. There should be no revisions to that data, but there's constantly these revisions. And again, this is the problem with surveys and all these other things that you manipulate, because you do manipulate them. You know, you doing seasonal adjustments, that's a manipulation of the data. That's not the real data. You're manipulating the data for an outcome. And then yes, we can all come up with reasons why we need to do this. We have a lot of layoffs in January because of the holiday shopping, but you really don't need to. As we said before, if you just use the 12-month average of the data, solves all your problems, and you just use the actual data, put a 12-month average on it, and you're good. And you get the same results ultimately, but you get a better, more reliable result by doing that. So, you know, again, we're going to come back, revise all this data. And by the way, we've had this gap in the household survey before, and they magically revise that number and the gap goes away. So, you know, that's what I'm saying. We don't pay attention to these revisions, but down the road, a year from now and 3 years from now, we'll revise all this data. And then you and I will be sitting here maybe, talking about, did you see what they did? You know, remember that massive jobs report we had back in 2023? Yeah, well, we were actually all losing jobs. Well,
it was all phantom. Yeah.
Yeah. But market won't care by then. The economy doesn't care by then. Who's ever in office doesn't care by then. So, you know, we have to go with the data we have because that's what drives the markets. We can analyze it and piece it all day long. But at the end of the day, the market only cares about what the report is.
Yeah. You know, I have largely looked at this as smoke and mirrors, right? That this was sort of intentional to just try to keep everything looking rosy. And then, as you said, later on, we'll revise it. And by that time, the market will have moved on and doesn't care, right?
Yep.
I still think there's a lot of that going on. But I interviewed consumer researcher Nili Timinga this week. And she actually is in pretty close contact with the folks at the BLS.
Yep.
And what she thinks is likely going on is that we deformed the job market data so much during COVID, where we fired tens of millions of people and then had to rush to hire them back, that we basically broke the models. Yep. So it's sort of the bullwhip effect, where there's just big, massive, you know, waves of adjustments that are rippling through the BLS models to the point where until that equilibrates, they're just not useful. Like, we still print them, they take their best guess, but it's really not useful because the data has been so agitated, right?
Yeah. Well, and it was interesting in the State of the Union address last night. You know, President Biden was touting the fact that, you know, they've created 15 million jobs, strongest amount of job growth of any president ever. And that's a true number. But the problem is that a vast majority of those jobs were just basically hiring people back that you fired.
You're adding them back. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, you know, the real job, so, you know, we have to net out all those rehires to get what the real job growth was, which would be much more in line with norms. And again, you know, there's been definitely job growth and job creation, no doubt about that. But it's certainly not the strongest ever in history because of this. And to the BLS's and to your interview's point is that massive firing of jobs and then rehiring those people to come back have completely blown those models out the window.
All right, I'm looking for a data point that I thought I had a link to, but I guess I don't. So an important development of this most recent payrolls report is that the unemployment rate bumped up to 3.9%, right? Jumped up from 3.7 to 3.9%. And that's notable because even with all these, you know, great beats and great data, you know, unemployment's beginning to move. One of the things that the chart I can't find is it's a chart of initial claims versus WARN notices.
Yeah.
And if you look at it, initial claims are still pretty, they're very low and they're very flat. They really haven't moved very much. Where WARN notices over the past like 8 months or so have been moving high into the right at a 45 degree angle. So, you know, companies are out there basically letting their employees know that they're going to, that there are layoffs coming, right? And of course, we've seen layoffs, actual layoffs, jump pretty dramatically so far in 2024. But there's this real disconnect right now between the official data, like the claims, right? And what we can see employers actually doing, which is announcing layoffs, warning their employees through the WARN Act and whatnot. And I was asking Neely actually about this, and she said, yeah, you know, it's coming, right? Like we're, you know, unemployment's going to start moving here as those WARN notices start turning into actual layoffs. And she said one of the things that's been delaying all this has been the length of severances that were getting paid out were much longer than what were previously offered, right? People were getting, you know, in certain cases, 6 months or more severance payments. And, you know, that was definitely very prevalent in the tech layoffs in 2022. What's interesting about that is she's saying, you know, she gets reports on from companies about what type of severance programs they're offering. And she's like, wow, there were companies that were doing multiple months that are now doing like, you get your 2 weeks and that's it, right? So the length of those severance and the generosity of those severance packages is really coming down now. So basically all this is her saying, like, we're getting close to the point where the impact of these layoffs is not going to be masked anymore. And we're going to start really seeing that reflected in the data. And who knows what's going to happen from here. I just want to note that when you look at a chart of the U3 unemployment rate, which is the main one that gets reported in the media, when we go into layoffs, that unemployment rate, it's, you know, stable, and then it spikes going into recession. Like once it starts moving, it starts moving really fast. Are we at that stage yet? Are we getting close to it? Who knows? But it's important to note that it's finally beginning to move up and almost break into a four handle where it's been so muted for so long.
Yeah. So I was, while you were talking, I was just recreating a chart that I haven't updated it today. So I apologize. This is my actual spreadsheet. So forgive the other garbage that's around it.
Hey, but we get to see how the sausage is made. It's great.
Yeah, exactly. So this is full-time employees relative to the working age population. And I mentioned this last month when you and I were talking, because there was a very interesting issue last month that we had this massive drop in the population. We lost 451,000 people were just magically extracted from the population last month. And so I was curious if the drop in the full-time employment to population ratio was a function of just that decline in the working age population. This month, there was the population growth kind of returned to normal. So we added 171,000 people to the working age population this past month. And yet the full-time employees relative to the working age population dropped again. So we're now down to 49.66% of the population. This goes back to what I was saying, you know, the Biden last night during the State of the Union was touting this very strong economic employment growth, best ever on record. Yet the number of people working full time relative to the working age population never even got back to the pre-COVID peak and has now declined from that. As we talked about last month, normally when you see declines like this, that are this sharp, is usually heading into a much more severe economic slowdown. The reason is obvious that, as you know, I need a full-time job to, you know, raise a family and pay for a mortgage and get healthcare benefits and all that. So if I'm losing full-time employment relative to the population, that's going to translate into weaker economic growth at some point in the future. So, you know, it's interesting. I thought maybe last month was an anomaly because of that reason that we just lost 500,000 people. Yep. But now we've added people back to the role and, you know, still have reduced
that. The numbers going down. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a much more relevant number now.
Wow. All right. I'm going to steal the screen share back to show this chart, which is the correlation between the private non-farm payrolls and the NFIB Small Business Hiring Plans Index.
Yep.
So you can see it's a pretty tight correlation. We've got more advanced data for the business hiring plans, and they've just dropped like a rock, yep, basically since the end of last year and now. So if that correlation still holds, well, payroll should follow suit.
Yeah. And again, look, you know, small businesses, we just wrote about this last week or week before last, we talked about the NFIB, its relation to small cap stocks in particular. There's a very high correlation between the NFIB confidence index and small cap stocks. And again, this is what I was talking about. And that was one of the charts we included in that article about retail speculators. But, you know, small businesses make up 50% of the employment in the economy, and they are very sensitive to changes in spending by consumers. So if demand slows even a bit, they're going to cut back on CapEx plans, they're going to cut back on employment plans, which is exactly what we're seeing them do right now anyway.
Wow. Okay. So I'm got a long list of stuff we still have yet to talk about. We're beginning to run out of time, so I'm jettisoning stuff out of the balloon here. But around consumer spending, increasingly I keep seeing more and more both data and anecdotal reaction to consumers about the cost of living, right, but specifically around food. There was a TikTok video I just saw. I was trying to see if I could get it in here, and I couldn't find it this morning. But it was a dad who went shopping for his family of four. He bought basically ingredients for two dinners. And mm-hmm. He was like, look, I actually, with the exception of the tomato sauce, you know, for the pasta, which I'm a quality nut on the tomato sauce, you know, everything else was basically the lowest version that I could buy. I said, how much do you think this cost? And it was something like $160. Mm-hmm. And he was like, I can't do that. Like I'm trying to make the cheapest meal I can for my family of, you know, what we're eating here. And it was some sort of pasta based disc. It wasn't like caviar. Right. And he was just like, I don't know what to do. Like, I don't know how I'm going to, he's like, I actually do okay relative to most of the people I know in terms of income wise, but he's like, this is really stretching me. And I don't know how the regular person's, you know, going to be able to do this. So, I want to combine that with the fire that's going on right now in your state, in Texas, right? Largest wildfire in Texas history. Mm-hmm. It's in the part of the panhandle where I think something like 10 million cattle are there, which is a huge part of the cattle production, the beef production for the country. They don't know how much cattle has been killed yet, but it's not going to be immaterial. And before the fires hit, what was this? The U.S. cattle herd was the smallest it had been since 1951. And similarly, up in Canada, their cattle herd is the smallest in 30 years. So, you know, that's obviously not going to help for food price inflation for anybody that wants to eat beef-related protein, right? So when I was talking to Neely, you know, she was actually saying, look, I actually think, like, economically, looking at the consumer and all the different types of consumers, she's like, I think we're going to muddle through, she said, unless two things happen. She said, unless the over-leveraged consumer really starts tapping out, and then if the maturity wall, like if the Fed doesn't ride to the rescue in time and the maturity wall hits the over-leveraged corporate fleet hard and they have to start. So, you know, either the over-leveraged consumer reduces their spending, which in an over-leveraged population, she put it was like 20 to 30 million Americans fall into her over-leveraged segment, you know, the more over-indebted companies have to start firing people because their debt is re-rated, right? And it's kind of thing like, look, I mean, unless rates come down sometime real soon, I can see pretty decent probability of either of those things happening. So I'm just curious, from the things that you look at, how concerned are you about what you were talking about, which is consumer spending starts, you know, getting crimped because consumers are just saying, yeah, I it's getting hard to even put food on the table.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's the real risk. I'm not too worried about, you know, the credit side. If you take a look at what's going on with small cap companies right now, in particular, small and mid caps, they're refinancing debt using collateralized loans. So, you know, leveraged loan obligations. So they're able to they're taking on a lot more risk by doing it, but they're able to get some of that debt refinanced. And we've seen a big surge in that kind of debt offering over the recent last several months. So we're seeing some of that refinancing activity occur. There's absolutely, you know, we've said before, if you're concerned about a major market event, All you got to do is pay attention to credit spreads. There is no risk in credit spreads right now. There is the credit market is pricing in no event of significance. That's why we may have a 5 to 10% correction this year, but you're not going to see a 30, 40, 50% correction, at least not now, because the credit markets are not pricing in any such event. And they will. They're very sensitive to fundamentals. So, you know, pay attention to credit spreads. That's your biggest friend in terms of managing money. When it comes to the economy, though, that's a little different story. That we could see, you know, I still think we're going to see a much more significant economic slowdown over the next 12, 18, 24 months. Again, you know, the GDP declining back towards sub 2%, inflation coming down more sharply, and that'll be a function of consumers literally tapping out, so to speak. Because again, you know, when you have food making up 30% of discretionary incomes, it's just getting onerous. And I agree with, you know, that point of view, which is, even my wife and I, we make good money. And, you know, it's just, we just kind of don't go out to eat anymore, because I just, you know, I like going out with her, you know, having a date with my wife and going out with, that's our kind of our time together, but it's just getting so expensive and the quality of the food sucks.
Yeah. It gets so ruined when the bill comes and then you're like, what? And then they say, oh, and you know, well, do you want to pay a 25% or 30%?
Well, like we had a date. So I took her out on a date. She had had a really hard day at work. And so I took her out on a date and we went to this restaurant. It's a pretty nice restaurant and it has a nice atmosphere. It's nice decor. And we've been going there for years and we don't go very often. I mean, we do that type of dinner maybe once a quarter. So it's not something we do on a regular basis. So we don't go to this restaurant all the time. But we have been to this restaurant before. And normally when we go, you know, we both eat fairly healthy. So I had ordered, you know, this dinner that was a grilled chicken breast and it came with a salad and came with a side of rice and black beans. I know it sounds boring for most people, but that's what I eat. But normally the chicken breast is probably, you know, 8 to 10 ounces. It's a good healthy size chicken breast. Right. And I like going to this one restaurant in particular. I'm not going to name the name. But I like going there because their portions were always well, you know, well designed. That, you know, it was always a nice piece of chicken and, you know, very juicy, very tender. And so when I got my plate this time, I think it was a quail, or maybe a dove, because this was the smallest chicken breast I've ever seen. And yet it cost me about 30% more than what we used to pay.
Shrinkflation. So,
well, it is. And it's exactly that. And, you know, but my point is that, and to your point, it kind of ruined the whole dinner at that point. And, you know, and both my wife and I just kind of looked at it as like, yeah, we're not going to do this again. Yeah. We'll, you know, cause we enjoy cooking at home. You know, our thing is just to spend time together. She works, I work, she works very long hours. She travels a lot. So when we're together, we want to spend time together. We enjoy cooking together. And so we've just decided that we're just going to spend more time just cooking at home and, you know, and having our dates that way. And it's not like these dinners are a big offset for our incomes, because again, we make decent money, but it's just spending that money. And then they want 20, 25% tips on top of it.
It's just, right. Right. It just ruins them. Yeah.
It's just getting ridiculous. And, you know, and I even had this conversation to your point. I had this conversation is that I don't know how people that make average American incomes are making it. I will tell you this, I have noticed in the last couple of months in particular that, like, if I have a lunch meeting with a client or whatever, that restaurants are not nearly as busy as they used to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm hearing anecdotally and even seeing some myself that the, whatever you want to call it, the revenge spending or just the, you know, like I don't oftentimes go to a mall but when I certainly would go to the airport, and I'd be like, how come there's no parking spots here? Like, you know, we were coming out of this, you know, economic shutdown and, you know, there was a shock to the world economy, but like, oh my God, everybody's going on vacation. Right.
Yeah.
I'm taking my daughter on spring break next week. And 4 years ago, when my older daughter was graduating high school, we made the same trip, and prices and availability are notably better at the destination now than they were back then.
I'm gonna be on spring break next week too. So,
Well, enjoy, my friend. I know you very kindly offered to take a bullet and still record this with me, so thank you. And I will repay the favor when I'm on my trip. Just a funny story on this topic too. Last night, my daughter and I, our weekly ritual is we go to pub trivia every Thursday night. So we went last night, and she asked if she could get a sandwich, and I said sure. Gave her my card. So I don't know if you remember the story I told about the $35 BLT. Yep. In my town. So she went, she got her sandwich, she gave me the card. I go home and I get the little receipt on my phone. And I was like, what? 30? What? For the? And I looked and she went to that same place, got a different sandwich. But I was like, son of a. I mean, yeah. How you can justify a sandwich that costs over 30 bucks when all is said and done is freaking ridiculous. It's obscene. Yeah,
it is.
All right. So had a pretty good rant for this week, which we'll push off to next week because I know you got to leave in just a couple minutes, Lance. And I get to my wrapping up, general wrapping up. What I will say, just for human interest here, is we've talked in the past about the benefits of hanging, of dead hanging. We've talked about on this channel. I'll tell you, I probably get more random tweets and emails from people about that topic saying, I thank you so much. I had no clue about it. And I'd had shoulder problems for years and I started hanging. And oh my God, within the first week, it started going away. You know, and a lot of lifetime converts now apparently to dead hanging, which is great. I'm so happy to have helped people there. I'm in the process of learning a new, I think what'll be sort of in a similar class as that in terms of just health benefits, but it's a lot harder to do. And this is the cold plunge. So this week I've been thinking about it for a long time. I've heard folks like Andrew Huberman extol the benefits of it. Problem is, I hate the cold. I grew up in New England. I did my time there, right? I still think it's too cold for me here in Northern California. So to intentionally walk into water that's like 50 degrees or colder is super not pleasant. And it is the absolute last thing my brain wants to do. And it's miserable. I'm not gonna lie. The first 40 seconds are absolutely miserable. But having now done it a couple of times, like I get it. The way your body feels afterwards, it's like a flushed feeling that you enjoy really for the rest of the day. And you know, there's a whole litany of health benefits that you're supposed to get from it. One of which that I'm already kind of beginning to see is it really helps reduce inflammation. So if you have joint pain or if you've got sort of chronic issues with parts of your body, it'll oftentimes reduce the inflammation low enough to let the blood flow in there and really accelerate the healing. So anyways, more about this. I'll maybe take a quick little video of it and put it up on the screen next time so folks can just see how miserable it is. But folks, if I can do it, if it's something you've been thinking about, you can do it. And you only have to be in there for, they say, just a minute to 3 minutes to get the benefits. In fact, they say if you stay longer, a lot of people's ego get involved. And so they're like, oh, I'm going to try to go for 8 minutes or 10 minutes. They say you really don't get much additional benefit for that additional pain. So while it is miserable, it's relatively quick. But anyways, that's something you'd ever think about doing?
Oh no, and I for me, it's always been the issue of just, I'm always short on time, right? So I go run or whatever I'm going to do, and then to get the bathtub filled up, get the ice transported in, the whole nine yards through the cold plunge, it just takes too much time. So I take cold showers. And again, it's not the same effect, but you do get the same negative effect, which is shrinkflation. but it's shrinkage, Jerry. It's shrinkage.
Like a frightened turtle, right? Isn't that
this? So, but yeah, other than that, and also remind me, I have a rant that we need an educational rant next week. If you can make a note about the difference between a constitutional republic and a democracy.
Okay. And just for the record, folks, spoiler alert is we have the former.
Yeah.
Or at least.
But it's just because you're hearing a lot of this in the media right now about threats to democracy and all this with the election coming up. I think it's just very important to understand the value of, what a constitutional republic is versus a democracy, which is mob rule, why we have an electoral college and why it's important. And why we have the House of Representatives and the Senate the way it's set up. I mean, these are all very, apparently a lot of people in the media have not taken a civics class. Mm-hmm. So I think it's just as we're getting ready to go in an election and you're going to go cast a vote, you should at least understand what you're voting for.
Right. Especially too, as emotions get whipped up, So the closer we get, you want to be thinking logically about the structure of how our political system is supposed to work, or at least our form of governance is supposed to work.
But we have that.
I did not ask you.
Can do that rant.
Okay. I've written it down. Trades, very importantly, before we lose you.
None this week.
None
this week. It's just been, you know, this market just keeps grinding higher. And, you know, at this moment, we're pretty fully allocated. And, you know, again, it's just, you know, our big debate right now is, you know, we should trim these stocks back, you know, just, you know, they're, you know, have had great runs. We should sell them. But if we start doing that, we start impeding performance in a market that just kind of keeps grinding higher. So this is what I was saying earlier, is that you can take some, we've done some profit taking, we've done some rebalancing, but we're now to the point that if we do any more or we start hedging, we're going to start impairing performance in the portfolio relative to our benchmark. So we've got to be a little bit cautious here. And this is what I was saying, is that we're watching that 20-day moving average very closely. If we break that, violate it, confirm it, then we'll start reducing equity, because at that point we will have the market telling us what to do rather than guessing at it.
All right. Well, look, we'll start wrapping up here. Folks, if you enjoy these weekly market recaps, even more than we enjoy our constitutional republic, let Lance know by hitting the like button and then clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. Just a last reminder about the conference. You've only got a week left to sign up for it, so do it now if you haven't yet. Sadly, the early bird price is behind us, no matter what Lance said. Sadly, there will be no Ginsu knives along with it as well. But you will get over 9 hours of you will get over 9 hours of incredibly dense, financially nutritious content with many of the best experts ever to come on this channel. So to sign up for that, go to thoughtfulmoney.com/conference. And then, as we say every week, you know, Lance has done a really good job this one from his eagle point of view, saying, you know, correction risk is getting higher and higher the longer the market continues its current trajectory. So he's ringing a bell of caution. Again, not crash tomorrow and not sell everything, but he's ringing a note of caution. And most folks who are trying to navigate this, especially if we're in, you know, we're all retail investors mostly watching this, which we would be called the dumb money. I don't want you to be the dumb money. So make sure you don't become the dumb money. And in most cases, that's going to, your best chances of that are going to be working with a good professional financial advisor who can be guiding you here through this process. If you've got a good one who takes into account all the issues that Lance and I talk about here and is doing that for you, great. But if you don't have one or would like a second opinion from one who does, consider scheduling a free consultation with one of the financial advisors that Thoughtful Money endorses, perhaps even Lance and his team there at Real Investment Advice. To do that, just go to thoughtfulmoney.com, fill out the short form there, only takes a couple of seconds. And as a reminder, these consultations, they're completely personalized to your specific situation. They are totally free. There's no commitment to work with these guys. It's just a free public service that they offer to help as many people as possible navigate what's coming as prudently as possible. Lance, as usual, my friend, I'm going to give you the last word here.
That's it. I'm good. I'll see you next Friday after spring break. Have a good one.
All right. That's all, folks. You're just going to be the Porky Pig ending here.
That's it. That's all, folks.
All right. Well, buddy, thanks so much again. Another great week. Enjoy your time off with your spring break next week. Thanks again for coming on Friday to record this with me then. And everybody else, hope you enjoyed this. Thanks so much for watching.